Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Crazy though it may be, I assume many of us have accepted the fact that the Republican Party has a problem with science, and ultimately with evidence, facts, reality. It's now a matter of politics for them to deny science. Among their presidential primary candidates, only John Huntsman and Mitt Romney accept that warming is happening and humans are a contributing factor. Chris Mooney has been on this trail for years. He wrote the best-selling The Republican War on Science in 2005. Now, by the time that their anti-science, anti-reality bias was pretty firmly established, Mooney was asking a deeper question. Did science have anything to teach us about why? And it turns out, recently, science does. That brings us to Chris's new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. According to Mooney, from climate change to evolution, the rejection of mainstream science among Republicans is growing. Not only that, so is denial of expert consensus on the economy, American history, foreign policy, and much more. Now, why won't Republicans accept things that most experts agree on? Why do they fight facts? He writes that the political parties reflect personality traits and psychological needs. Republicans wedded to certainty, Democrats to novelty, and that this is the root of our divide over reality. Hopefully, understanding how or why Republicans deny science and facts should suggest ways to interact and work with that, quote, reality in some different way that makes us more effective moving forward. That's what we're going to look at towards the end of this hour. Chris Mooney hosts the Point of Inquiry podcast and writes the Intersection blog for Science Progress. He's written for Mother Jones, American Prospect, Harper's, Washington Post, USA Today, Slate, among other publications. He's the author of The Republican War on Science, Unscientific America, and his newest, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. Welcome again, Chris Mooney.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Now, as we said before we went on the air, you and I have had a number of these conversations over the past few years. I recall the first one at Caltech on your very first book.
That's right. I was a baby.
Yeah, you were. You're like, he graduated Yale and suddenly he's here. And you started writing about Republican thinking and politics and policies, especially where they ignored or denied science. But I'm curious, when did you begin, and don't answer the question right now, when did you begin to focus on their actual brains, and when did the question of how and why they were prone to deny science or reality take center stage, and how did you move from that moment to the present? Now, what I'm suggesting, Chris, is we both know, and this brain science and stuff vindicates it, the unique value and power of story, narrative. So what I want us to do in most of this interview is unfold the narrative of your personal search for that answer. You know, you found this out and that sent you down this trail. You heard about this study and that sent you down this trail and so on, so that we both get the findings that you had, but also the story of your search. So first, let's go further back. Today, you're someone who writes about science and politics, but I assume that's not what you set out to do.
No.
So what's your purpose to that?
Okay, let's go back to the crib.
Yeah.
I'm a psychological liberal. I now know this about myself.
Right.
So I wanted to be a writer, natural. You know, some of us want to paint, some of us want to play the guitar, some of us want to write, you know. I wanted to do it in any form. Originally, I wanted to do it creatively. At some point in college, I started to do it journalistically. I loved science because my grandfather was a scientist, and he was a biologist, and to him, evolution was the explanation for everything, kind of to me, too, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't not look at the world through that lens. And so as I began writing nonfiction, it seemed inevitable that I had to be a science writer. It seemed to me to just have a kind of insight that you didn't have, a kind of real reliability of knowledge that you didn't have if you're talking about things in other ways.
I mean, it's interesting, actually, because I've noticed and I've mentioned on the air that I've begun to actually do more interviews about science, more interviews with scientists and science writers. You're right. It is something where there seems like there's something there. And it's interesting. The public seems very interested in writing about science.
Jonah Lehrer, who I had on recently, his book went to number one like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this was true 10 or 15 years ago. So you knew you were going to write. You started writing about science. You found you liked it. What were you focusing on when the idea for the Republican War on Science took you?
Well, I was a political journalist in Washington, D.C., at the American Prospect magazine, and I covered politics. You know, I would write, like, an Enron article or something. This is, like, 2001, 2002, but certainly I gravitated more towards science when I could, so that meant writing, like, the stem cell article, you know? And it turned out that it was pretty easy to corner the market on that in a political publication, you know, become the guy who does that kind of stuff, right? And so it was easy to find yourself that way, and that's what I did. And then I dropped out, went freelance, and started, I guess, relatively early to notice the bubbling up of this series of stories and complaints about the Bush administration and science. And I'll never forget, you know, a bioethicist who I had used as a source many times. He's America's most quoted bioethicist, Arthur Kaplan. He's always on TV because he's just really entertaining and great.
So it helps to be a good scientist and good on TV.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he said, I remember, he said, Chris, why don't you, I don't know why I was talking to him. He knew my work well. He said, why don't you look at all this stuff about the Bush administration and science? You know? And I said, okay, not a bad idea. And sure enough, you know, that went down that rabbit hole, and I came up with the Republican War on Science, you know, with roughly a year later. And that set it all in motion.
Okay. And this next thing that I said, which is that you put that one out there, you were one of the main ones pointing to it, but by, you know, as I say, by now it's pretty well established. People got that. When did you begin to focus on the deeper question?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just
say one thing about Bush, though.
Sure.
Pretty well established, but honestly, Bush looks moderate now on science. He looks calm and reasonable compared to what we're now looking at. So just put that on the table.
You're correct.
Yes,
you're
absolutely.
Correct.
All right.
The whole thing about that is amazing, isn't it? I mean, you know, on the one hand, if you go broader, it's like Nixon, mm-hmm. you know, more progressive than Obama.
Right.
On most things.
Yeah, Bush never said, you know, Santorum-like things about global
warming.
That's
right. When I said that only two of them granted global warming might exist and that humans might be contributing to it, we're talking about kind of out of nine, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think...
Yeah, and I think you're being too charitable to Romney.
That's right.
Yeah.
He has said those things but now might disavow them.
Yeah, might have backpedaled on that.
Huntsman was the only one,
right.
Which is why he remained at 1%.
Right. Well, it certainly didn't help him, yeah. So I'm sorry, I've lost our.
No. You were just pointing out that, uh-huh. that things have.
Okay, so let's talk about why did we need to go into the brain, right?
Yeah.
I will tell you the story. I think the first time I caught wind of this, two moments really, and so let's take them in stride. I'm not sure which came first, but this guy Brendan Nyhan. He does wonderful research. He's a political scientist at Dartmouth. And I had known him for 10 years, going back to, you know, early days, 2000s, journalism in D.C. And he was always, like me, a devotee of rationality in our discourse. And he ran something called Spin Sanity, where they tried to, became quite popular, and they tried to set the record straight when people were systematically distorting evidence. And what he learned was that people didn't change from that endeavor. Right, and so he went on to become a political scientist, and he started to study that, and he's done all these fascinating motivated reasoning studies, some of which I discuss in the book, and the most striking of them is where he gets a backfire effect in Republicans. He and Jason Reifler, who's his colleague, get a backfire effect in Republicans when they refute false claims that Republicans believe. And what that means is that if you refute the false claim, then the Republican or conservative believes it more strongly than if you hadn't refuted it. Okay, so this obviously requires a psychological explanation, doesn't it? So they did this with the claim that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. They did it in the form of a newspaper article. You read the article, a controlled experiment, and the article contains the false claim stated by George W. Bush. And then the experimental manipulation is you either do or do not read a correction.
Mm.
Right.
Okay.
And the correction makes the belief worse, is what they found. On that belief.
So that people who only saw the assertion
believed
it at X percent.
Yeah.
And people who saw the assertion and the dispute.
They doubled down.
The correction, they doubled down. And,
yeah.
and even more of
yeah.
them believed.
Yeah, even more.
Crazy. You said one of the leading things was the fellow at Dartmouth who was dealing with motivated reasoning, the backfire effect, and...
And then the second, and I know exactly when I came across this, is what I now call the smart idiot effect. All right, and so it was Pew Data, 2008, about, you know, Democrats and Republicans have completely divorced in terms of their view of reality about global warming, right? And that was the main headline from the Pew poll. But in the Pew poll, they had really fascinating data on the relationship between your level of education and what you believed, depending on whether you were Democrat, Republican, or Independent. And what it showed was that if you were a Republican, then the higher your level of education, then the less likely you were to accept scientific reality, which is that global warming is caused by humans. But for Democrats and Independents, the relationship between education and acceptance of reality goes in the opposite direction. So what is this?
Right? Yeah.
What is this thing, this what I called later the smart idiot effect? The smarter ones, or at least the better educated ones later, other studies now show it's the ones who claim to be more knowledgeable. I mean, there's different ways of measuring it, but they're always more wrong.
The ones who claim to be more knowledgeable.
Claim to know more about
and
the
may,
issue.
In fact, know more information.
Indeed, they may well. They may
some
be,
of the tests have shown that, right?
Yeah, I think I'll take them at their word for that.
Yeah. That actually, that doesn't lead them more toward
truth.
Actuality or
no.
truth. It leads them further away.
Right. So what is, and they've found that now on also a belief that Obama is a Muslim. False. And they found that on belief that the healthcare bill created death panels. False. Right, but they always find this inverse relationship, and I'm sure it exists on many other topics, but those are the only ones that's been captured in studies. Inverse relationship between education or level of self-described knowledge and knowing the truth.
So at the risk of being redundant, these two things are one that when you receive correcting information, you get more entrenched in your incorrect opinion.
Correct.
And when you know more, are perhaps more educated, more knowledgeable, you actually are more insistent and more passionate about the incorrect information.
Or just more wrong.
More wrong. Okay, fine.
I mean, why it's happening is then the next question. But so these are both things on the right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And those same things tested on the left?
I've not seen many parallels for those kinds of things on the left. Now, to be fair, I bet you could probably set up a situation in which you might find something like that on the left. But I think it would be, you'd be straining yourself a little bit.
Right.
And
we will, this is, by the way, this is a theme that we'll come back to, which is that are there smart idiots on both sides? Are there, and what, if you could just umbrella summation on that, is sure there are examples, sure there must be and so on, but as a trend, as a real repeating thing, it seems to reside on the right.
And also, I mean, I know counterexamples on the left. For example, this guy, Dan Kahan at Yale, did another kind of – he captured the smart idiot effect on global warming basically in another study. But what was fascinating was that the, quote, liberals – he measures them a little differently than just do you call yourself a liberal, but basically they're liberals. He did them on nuclear power because that's supposed to be the counterexample, right? Conservatives, you know, are against the scientific community on global warming and liberals are against it on nuclear power because scientists think as a whole – that the nuclear power risks are overblown, right? That's what they think. And that really is what they think. So, but that is not what happened with level of education and the left on nuclear power. Level of education made them more like what scientists think.
Okay. So you got that, folks, so, that in that one, they're against nuclear power. Now you say, but that counters.
Yeah, they start off being more against it than conservatives. But with level of education, they become more accepting, so they don't go in the way that their emotions would take them.
That's
right.
They don't. The emotions don't strengthen their resolve.
Right.
They
go the other way.
Lean towards the experts.
Yeah. And so that's different.
Yeah. I mean,
and in fact, in a study, we're jumping ahead now. We do in the book. We only did it with 144 undergraduates, but it's the last chapter of the book. We did nuclear power again, and because it's always the test case. If you want to find liberal bias, it's one of them. And what we found was that conservatives were more biased than liberals on nuclear power based upon where their starting point was. And if you give them information that challenges them, then the liberals were more willing to move than the conservatives were. So
even on the one that's usually
even on the one that's
and
supposed
to be. And most people haven't done the both, right? They've just tested liberals on that one, and you tested both.
We did test both.
Yeah.
They were both in Kahan's study.
Okay.
But you were looking for the liberal movement versus the conservative movement.
Right.
You could say, oh, nuclear power is not really a good test case. I mean, you could say the left isn't up in arms about it the way it was 40 years ago. Maybe that's true. But show me – I don't know what the test case is.
Right,
then.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure we'd be happy to do more experiments, but I really think that the left and the right process information differently.
And that's what we're going to end up talking about, is what is it? And so let me make sure that I'm getting my story straight here. Mm-hmm. So you come across these studies, you see the backfire effect, you see doubling down, you see smart idiots, and so on, and you go, why? Why? Now you're on a new track. Not is it so, but why does it happen? And where do you turn first?
Well, I don't know the moment when I just sort of, I think I was just reading. You know, the good thing about doing a book is you have time. I mean, it shows to clear your schedule, right? And so eventually I did, and I was just reading. I don't know when I came across the psychology of ideology research. And, you know, I didn't want to believe it at first. There's an article in Mother Jones that I did that went completely viral. And it's about motivated reasoning, which we've discussed.
And you and I remember when I saw that article, I said, let's do, I think we did a half an hour interview on that article.
Yeah.
So it was a teaser for this
interview. It was everywhere, right? And in there, if you look, then I say, you know, do liberals do it more than conservatives?
Oh, by the way, we've mentioned motivated reasoning twice. Mm-hmm. We haven't defined it.
Oh, motivated reasoning is just being impelled by your emotions to come up with the rationalizations. So emotions hit first. And something is close to the core of you, and so they trigger your retrieval of arguments from your memory to let you defend what you already think.
So it's reasoning motivated by emotion.
Yeah.
But now let me ask this. Isn't one of the things we've learned in studying this stuff over the last few years that everything comes through the emotions first?
Sure.
That everything, I mean, Damasio with Descartes' error and so on, everything gets mediated first by the amygdala, tagged by the amygdala, and then we think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But what's key in what you're talking about here is things that have potent emotions, things that have charge is what you're looking at, right?
Yeah. No, some psychologists question whether there is any cold reasoning. And the motivated reasoning is hot in the sense it's emotional. And so is there anything cold? I mean, that's – I've certainly heard
people –
Does
it even exist?
Yeah. I've heard people say it doesn't exist. Yeah. So certainly what we're looking at is motivated. And, yes, the emotions come first and they tag everything. And if you want to get in the brain, then it's the emotional tags that guide the memory retrieval, and then by the time you're actually a conscious thinking person, that's already happened.
That's right. Yeah. In other words, what we're saying is not that you feel the emotion and then do the reasoning.
You're not really aware.
It happens under awareness, under consciousness.
I mean, you might, if your views are threatened, you might get kind of hunched up, and you might feel bodily.
Right, in the extreme cases, you probably do feel the emotion.
You might feel in a bodily way
this
process. I mean, some of us do when we get really upset.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But so what we're talking about here is motivated reasoning, and so now what I said, but what you're really investigating is one where there's a charge. In other words, everything comes through and gets, you know, slight good, slight bad, slight yes, slight no, yes, that's me, yes, that applies to me, no, it doesn't. But when there's a charge, it really influences your reasoning, right?
And these psychology studies, they're trying to get a rise. I mean, they're giving people information that they believe, and then they're taking it away from them saying you're wrong. I mean, they're in a controlled experiment. So theoretically, you are pushing a button.
Right.
I mean, it's going to be different people are going to be more and less attached to it. But sometimes, you know, you ask them ahead of time before the manipulation, how strongly do you believe this? You know, how committed are you? That's what we did in our study that I talked to
you. So you got a baseline of some sort.
You get a baseline.
It's their view.
And
but
it's how much do they move against whatever
against
baseline.
Their own baseline.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my question was, when did you begin to find, oh, there's something here, there's stirrings of an answer, and you said when you in your reading, you don't know the date or anything, but you found this motivated reasoning.
Yeah.
And that seemed to put a piece of this together.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, yeah, and so then there's the psychology of ideology research, and originally I wasn't sold, and I kind of went on the one hand, on the other hand, with regard to that in the Mother Jones article. But basically, the more I read this work, and it's summarized, you know, the first real, you know, flag in the ground for the modern version of this is a 2003 paper in, I think it's Psychological Bulletin, by John Jost of New York University and his colleagues. And what they do is they synthesize some 80 studies about the psychological correlates of left-right ideology in different countries. All non-communist, so that's important. And so they find consistently in those bodies of studies that there's certain traits that reliably predict liberal conservative difference, right? And those include personality traits like openness to experience versus the lack thereof. You know, it includes psychological needs like the need for closure and need to have a certain belief. It includes tolerance of ambiguity versus intolerance of ambiguity and things like that. So the more I read and the more I realized how much interlocking research there was supporting that and how far researchers have gone since then, because it's been another 10 years, I kind of, my eyes opened, and I it occurred to me, this guy Jost has really developed, and it's not just him anymore, but he's really developed a really large body of evidence that nobody really seems to be able to refute, that says that ideology is partly impelled by these traits, and those traits are going to have huge implications for how we process information.
And so go over those traits again, and what I noticed was they're sort of in different arenas or different areas, but you can hear the similarity,
mm-hmm.
right? Openness to experience links to so
I think openness unites them all. The openness is a Big Five personality trait. And the Big Five personality scale is really a well-accepted way of measuring human personality, you know, and it's one of the five. And it means, you know, wanting to try new things, tolerance of ambiguity, novelty,
uncertainty.
So all
those things
are
clustered in that same.
Yeah, and there's, there's standard questions for measuring it. So when you look at then some of the related things like need for closure, I mean, that's the opposite of open.
Right.
But it's measured nicely. In a different way, but it's clearly related.
Yeah.
Tolerance of ambiguity, uncertainty, clearly related.
Yep.
Integrative complexity is this one where it's about how much can you see other points of view and pull them together to come up with a nuanced picture of an issue rather than seeing it in black and white. Authoritarianism is the opposite of openness, which is seeing things in black and white and not tolerating ambiguity. So they all kind of sound similar, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you again, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chris Mooney. We're talking about the interesting research and findings in his new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And you can learn more at RepublicanBrain.com or scienceprogressaction.org/intersection. Okay, so you found this stuff about what you call, and the word you call it, it's ideology and personality?
I was saying psychology of ideology.
Psychology of ideology. Now, that field didn't exist,
mm-hmm.
Although Adorno's authoritarian personality.
It goes back to that.
What is that? That's just post-World War II, right?
Yeah, and in fact, I found a funny Gilbert and Sullivan lyric from 1882 where they're joking about liberal and conservative children. Like the idea.
Oh, right. That's developmental, isn't it?
Right. So, I mean, ultimately, the psychology of ideology is not psychology anymore because, and this is another reason that I, as a science reporter, felt that I couldn't ignore it anymore, is that when it sends out its tentacles into other fields and they're all ratifying it, which is now happening, so you got the genetics of ideology, you got the biology of ideology, you got the physiology of ideology, you've got the cognitive neuroscience of ideology, you've got the, I'm not sure what you would call it, the attentional research on ideology, which is like where do your eyes go uncontrolled when you're shown different images. They're backing it up in all these fields. So it's hard to believe that it's all just a big mistake.
Yeah, or that it's all just a theory because it seems to cross.
Yeah.
Now, what you're telling me actually is that all, again, as I said, although, personality may go back, a lot of this is really new. Right? In other words,
mm-hmm.
it's in the
last... Adorno is old, but,
right,
but they don't accept his way of measuring authoritarianism anymore. That's been thrown out.
Because it wasn't really... He didn't really measure it.
Yeah,
right?
I don't really remember exactly the reason that it's thrown out. I believe it might have been... it might have been influenced by Freudianism or something like
mm-hmm.
that. So, but anyway, the way
which
we...
Which is a no-no now.
Yeah, well,
sure.
And I'm not positive that's correct.
Yeah.
But the reason... The way we measure authoritarianism now has changed... But it still works. I mean, and it's actually just about child rearing styles. They just ask them, do you want, what kind of child is a good child, obedient or creative? And that's the difference. They want obedient children.
And so now you're finding out. Okay, so now your psychology of ideology. You're finding that, and it's all starting kind of fitting into place. And what as you said, you went from someone who took that all with a grain of salt. And you took it all with a grain of salt because you didn't want to be
trained.
You didn't want to be wrong.
No, we're trained as journalists not to do this. I mean, your instinct as a reporter who's, breathed in Washington is not to go beneath the surface like this and not to go into people's heads. That's not what we do.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
It's the horse race, it's the money, maybe it's the policy, but the actual person.
And plus, liberals also want to believe in a lot of ways that people can change, and that, you know, if we could just take the blinders off of them and get that corporate money out, you know, they would come around and see the true way. And this flies in the face of that too, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you're on this trail, and you're finding stuff that what you're just saying actually goes against your journalistic instincts, goes against your plan was, I'll put this out there, but I'm not going to take a stand on it, right? I'm not going
to. Yeah, I certainly wasn't prepared at first to do what I ultimately did, which is to spend 4 chapters synthesizing it all. And essentially, I approach it as a journalist, but I synthesize it all, and I treat it as a pretty serious body of evidence that you're not going to be able to get around that easily.
Now, then how about the brain?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I do want to go back a little more detail to Lakoff and height and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But we haven't quite talked about the brain yet. We've been talking about psychology. What about the brain?
Well, the reason they went into the brain, right, in the sense of cognitive neuroscience, the reason that they went into the brain is that all of these psychological studies had already said, hey, you know, we have these differences between liberals and conservatives that are showing up, and where is ideology expressed? Where is personality expressed? There's only one place that it's going to be located. I mean, I joke in the book, quoting John Jost, he jokes in the book, you know, ideology is not going to be located in your elbow. So there were theoretical reasons to think that you would ultimately find liberal-conservative differences in the brain. And now there are a number of studies, not that many yet, but a number with consistent findings that do show brain differences between liberals and conservatives in key areas, which were the areas that they looked at precisely because of the theory that they already had.
So what are those differences?
Well, the first look was at the anterior cingulate cortex.
What happens there?
With brain reasons, always it does many things often, but anterior cingulate is seen as an error-detecting area, and you know, it makes you stop a habitual pattern of behavior and do something else. You know, they call it cognitive control, you know, sort of snapping to attention and thinking, oh, no, maybe not this, you know, maybe not that, you know. So that the idea was that would be associated with liberalism because it's associated with tolerance of uncertainty, ambiguity, and change, right? And so, voila, Jost goes to neuroscientists in his own department, I guess, because they're also at NYU, David Amodio. And they test liberals and conservatives on a task that activates the anterior cingulate. And the task is, you know, you're just looking at a screen, and you're supposed to press a button whenever you see, I think it's the letter M, you know, and every once in a while they throw you a W, and you have to stop. But, you're pressing M pretty fast, and you have to stop when you get the W, and you don't know when it's going to be. But I guess that you get it 1 in 5 times or something like that. That's classic anterior cingulate study. Liberals do better. Liberals activate the anterior cingulate more, and that's what they published. And that's when it started.
So the person who isn't doing that is missing the W?
I think they're pressing the button. In other words, yes, they would press the button when they're not supposed to.
Right. In other words, they're used to this behavior, so they just continue this behavior rather than letting the new information change their behavior.
Right.
Okay. Any more stuff about the brain?
Oh, sure.
But
you see, the point is to say, brain studies, you know, have a lot of controversy attached to them, and I think we ought to be careful in discussing them because it's new, and it's usually small groups of people when they do this. But the reason they did it was because they had all the psychology, so it's not unreasonable.
That's right.
You know,
right. It wasn't just a stab in the dark. They were looking to see if a brain study would confirm what they'd already found
in
the personality
study. And these papers are, you know, up to the standard of everything else in cognitive neuroscience, as has been explained to me by the researchers there. You know, you throw out all the brain studies, or you treat them all as just as good as anything else, and so you're finding left and right brain studies.
Just for listeners who are going, why is he being so cautious about that?
Because he's a liberal.
I hadn't even thought of the secondary reason, but of course that's it.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that neuroscience is a hot field. I mean, as I said, I've been having more and more neuroscientists on my show because I find it so fascinating. But you're also saying is it's a new field. And so that point you just made
I can tell you all the caveats about the Bruin studies that we could spend a lot of time
on. Right. But you're just saying, overall caveat, these studies that you cite stand up to the same standards of what's going on in brain science right now, and so you're willing to give them a grain of salt.
I wouldn't give them that much of a grain of salt if they didn't fit into a broader tapestry of evidence. It's important to think about science as a body of evidence. And, you know, when you have a body of evidence and this is just one piece of it, then you look at the whole of the evidence and then you start to realize, wait, okay, this is too much. This can't. There's got to be something here. It's like climate change. That's why we can prove happening, you know, 11 to 12 different ways, just snapping your finger, rattling off all the different kinds of changes, all of which are consistent with the theory based on physics that you can't assault. And, you know, it's a consilience.
That's right.
Of knowledge, right?
That's right. Yeah. It's not one finding. Mm-hmm. It's that the pattern, the weave, works from whatever angle you're looking at it.
And motivated reasoners will try to attack evidence they don't like by trying to refute one piece of evidence, and it does nothing to it.
Right.
Because they don't want to believe, and they're not aware of what they would have to actually do to refute the whole body of evidence.
Yeah, you know, it is funny when you jokingly said, I do this because I'm a liberal. As I was reading, preparing for this, as I was thinking about it, and even as we're doing this interview, and it must happen to you all the time, the irony of the very approach you take, the care you take, and so on, is all the nuances that we're looking at are all, you know, part of being the liberal personality.
Yes.
And ultimately, before we're over, when we talk about, well, what does this tell us about how we move forward, that thing that I sort of briefly alluded to in the introduction really becomes critical. That if you claim to believe in evidence, then you better believe in the evidence that telling an authoritarian personality evidence isn't going to make any difference.
I mean, not in areas that are really emotional.
Right. And if you if you have an overall goal of moving society or shifting the needle on something, you got to take this new reality, is the way I put it, this new reality, and fit it into your thing, and not try to do what you thought should work based on your cool reasoning.
Right.
And so on.
Exactly. There isn't any, so.
We're at about the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chris Mooney about his new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And you can learn more at republicanbrain.com or scienceprogressaction.org/intersection. And intersection is Chris's section of that website. We've talked about the psychology. We've talked about the brain. Is there an evolutionary purpose or benefit to the Republican brain? Mm-hmm. In other words, why? What's the evolutionary upside?
All right. So I got to be very careful in answering this question again. You know, liberal. So I suspect that there is, but I don't think that we have a good scientific account right now that is adequate to really explain why evolution, quote, made us. Because in this way, because to explain that, you would have to say it made us to be different, because we are.
Saying the very first question is not why did it make Republican brains. You're saying why did it make different types of brains?
Right. I mean, is the theory that evolution for some survival purpose created variability?
Flexibility,
that turned
diversity?
Into left-right in democracies? And, I mean, so in other words, or is there just noise in terms of who we are that's not there for any evolutionary purpose maybe, but it just turns out that in democracies it makes left-right? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. And that's – Jonathan Haidt actually makes an evolutionary case for some liberal-conservative differences in a stronger way than I do, and he plays up the genetic evidence somewhat more than I do. I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist.
Right.
I can ask the evolutionary question, and then I can say, I can see why people would be cautious about this. And the reason is, this has been discussed with respect to religion, too, right? There's clearly some, you know, genes predict religiosity, and some people have suggested that maybe that's good for us in some way, or it reflects our evolutionary origins, and Jonathan Haidt argues this.
Oh, he certainly does.
Yeah, and but there's a lot of people who would say, like, say, Steven Pinker, who would say that, no, this is called a byproduct. This is something that, you know, it just happens to be there, but it's not something that natural selection actually created.
Right, and so for people who are listening, just if I'm, let me see if I'm clarifying that with you, Chris. What you're saying then is that there are certain things which have survived the evolutionary process,
mm-hmm.
Not because they were essential,
mm-hmm.
but because they tagged along with something that was?
Right. Yeah, Stephen Jay Gould is famous for calling them spandrels, you know, and so that's, in other words, a part of architecture that, you know, is, you have to have it, but it's not like it was part of the design, it's just sort of there. And what he wanted to emphasize, Gould, was that not everything that, you know, every trait we see was something that natural selection acted on in order to increase reproductive fitness to, you know, so you get this question, is religiosity, you know, a byproduct, or was it acted on by evolution? Is politics a byproduct? So how am I going to solve that?
Right.
Right? And I'm not going to solve that.
Right. Well, yeah. let's take it down. If we accept that since this kind of two ways of thinking, the more addicted, the more, not my mistake, the more favoring openness versus favoring black and white or closeness, those sorts of things.
I see it as novel, exploratory defensive, too.
Very good. Exploratory defensive, mm-hmm. open, closed, those
right.
sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
That both have survived.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ask another revolutionary question. I can see the evolutionary purpose of openness,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
yeah.
we talk about adaptability as one of the crucial evolutionary mm-hmm. talents, if you will.
Yeah.
Have you asked people to speculate on the evolutionary benefit of closeness?
Oh, sure. Oh, God, I find that one more obvious.
Easily. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, no, you know, another way of describing this is approach avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go out and try things versus you try to protect yourself.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Oh, I hear you.
Survival is difficult, right? I mean, you know, especially not in a world prior to our modern one, all right? And if, you know, if you're under threat, then what is the thing that you focus on? You know, you hunker down, you protect the group, you form very strong bonds with your tribe, and you attack threats. Openness is actually somewhat harder to explain.
Right, but I'm such a liberal, I didn't
right.
see that.
Yeah, I think...
I get what you're saying, is that closeness is basically care. Careful, caution, and you don't get in trouble or killed mm-hmm. by not taking a chance.
You affirm firm structures, hierarchies, tribal relationships.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that.
So even social evolution, mm-hmm. it makes sense.
Of course, we are now talking about all this in an evolutionary way, aren't we?
Yeah.
So you tricked me into doing that, right? So then there is obviously a core part of who we are is openness, and that's the exploratory side. That's try things out. And, you know, if I'm going to, you know, hypothesize, I mean, maybe when life gets a little easier, you can indulge that a little more. And, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So now I've mentioned Lakoff and Haidt. Talk a little bit about both of, that's George Lakoff and Jonathan Haidt. Lakoff's been kind of around, I think his first book was probably at least 12 or 15 years ago, wasn't it, Moral Politics?
It's one of the earliest.
And Haidt, his book...
The Righteous Mind.
Is quite new, mm-hmm. last
yeah.
year.
I've read them. So what they're doing is a little different than what I'm reporting on, although I report on them too, right? What they've focused on is the morality of left and right, and we didn't really touch on that yet. Liberals and conservatives are clearly different along multiple dimensions, and that includes personality like we've talked about. But one of them is morality. In other words, what is your view of how the society should be structured? And it links back to motivated reasoning in a very important way, because morality is emotional. And if you have this, you know, if your mind is configured so that you think the society should be hierarchical, like a conservative does, then, you know, you rapidly emotionally fire in situations that challenge your morality, right? And then if you go that far, you then reason to defend your morality. And so that it links up nicely with
yeah.
that. So to me, as a journalist reporting on all of the research, it seems to me that Lakoff and Haidt are essentially saying the same thing about the moral differences between liberals and conservatives, which is that among conservatives there is much more of a sense of hierarchy and respect for authority and group or tribe. And that's one of the key points from Haidt. But I think that it is reflected fully in Lakoff's description of conservatives respecting a strict father family.
Yeah, Lakoff uses the model of the type of family, whether you are a strict father family or a nurturing father family.
Authoritarian family also.
Right.
It matches the authoritarian research too.
Right, and it's interesting how it goes to what sort of child would you have. I mean, he's a linguist, but he was definitely in tune with them on that one. Mm-hmm. So he says this strict versus nurturing. Mm-hmm. Haidt says
that moral intuitions, conservatives are more sensitive to the sense of authority being disrespected. That strikes them as a moral assault, and to the tribe being betrayed.
Right. Now, I think it's just because it's sort of helpful for someone who's this new to. Haidt says there are six.
Yeah, he keeps adding them.
No,
there used to be five, now there's
six.
He's
a liberal, obviously, because he's willing
sure.
to add.
Yeah.
But he says at this point there are six intuitions. And I'll read them just because it's easy. The sense of needing to provide care and protect from harm. That's one moral intuition. Mm-hmm. The sense of what is just and fair. The sense of loyalty and willingness to sacrifice for a group. The sense of obedience or respect for authority. The sense of needing to preserve purity or sanctity. And six, liberty versus oppression, right? Mm-hmm. And what he says is, and I think it's an interesting thing, is that when he tests, he finds liberals, as you said, give short shrift to a couple of them, whereas conservatives seem to apply all of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Liberals have gotten rid of, we don't care about authority. In fact, we defy authority.
And
the tribe for us has become humanity.
Ah.
And Haidt mostly is trying to be even-handed, but he says conservatives are more parochial because of the tribe thing. And then disgust sensitivity. They're going around feeling the emotion of disgust when they think about, gay marriage. They're feeling that. And frankly, they're probably feeling it towards liberals. And I don't think that we can really empathize with or relate to that kind of visceral disgust.
Now, where does that piece come in, that disgust piece?
He's better on this than me in terms of explaining it, but he relates it to, again, an evolution. He relates every one of these to an evolutionary origin. And here, disgust sensitivity is something that protects you from consuming, food that's rancid or something like that. And so it gets attached to notions of sexual purity. And you go from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got an idea now that there's brain differences, there's psychology differences, we've played around with the evolutionary.
Yeah, there's genetics too.
Talk to us a little bit about genetics.
Well, they do twin studies of liberals and conservatives, and twin studies are a very accepted mechanism for detecting traits that are inherited. We've got these big databases of twins.
Yeah.
Obviously height, if you look at people's height, you're going to find identical twins are closer than fraternal twins, duh, or eye color, duh. Identical twins are going to be closer because they share all their DNA.
Yeah.
So who thought that politics would turn out to be one of these traits? But in the twin studies, it always is. So it's
that identical twins are more likely to have identical political philosophies.
Well, similar, yeah.
Than fraternal.
Yes, right. And so they then have the twin study methodology, and they try to divide up, a trait into its genetic component, its shared family environment component, and then its component of, after you leave the nest.
Right.
And they give politics 40% or more to the genetic component. That's how they do it. And they've done it across countries. So what does this mean?
Yeah. Okay. Let's get to the what does it mean. And let me tell you again, I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Chris Mooney about his new book, The Republican Brain. Obviously, what I want to learn from this is how, as a society, do we take advantage of this and move in sort of a forward direction. Now, there's tons of biases in that for me, and I'll admit to them. In other words, I think as we begin to see the tribe as larger and have more diverse people in our tribe, I think that's a positive thing. As we take care of the weakest among us and so many of us, you know, are becoming seniors who are going to live longer, that's going to be an issue bigger than it's been before. All these sorts of things, I think it's a positive thing. So I put that bias out there. How are we going to use what you've learned and examined and put out here to actually change the way we communicate, change the way we organize and so on? What does this tell us about how – and let me just go back for anybody who's new to this, who's just tuning in. Basically, there's a kind of approach that doesn't care about reality and evidence as much as it does about its biases. We've established that. What we want to say is if you are a liberal who says you care about evidence, then you have to take the evidence that there are those who don't care and not ignore it and not wish it would go away and not wish that facts would change it. What does this tell us about moving forward?
So there's several ways to attack that question. And, you know, I think the first is to attack it in the ideal world where probably doesn't exist, where everybody just says, okay, uncle, we're all going to accept that this is true. And I don't think that we're in that world. I think that basically all the evidence suggests, including evidence I relate in my book and evidence in the response to my book, is that conservatives are going to just feel very, very offended and threatened by all this, and so they're not going to accept it.
And let me just jump in there. One of the things that has happened, you've been attacked as saying that you are saying that their brains aren't as good.
Or they're hardwired, or none of these. You know, people don't understand any of the science, and they'll make these claims. And they don't read the book, and they make these claims. But that just shows that they are extraordinarily defensive, which is what it's all about, right? It's what the book's about.
Right.
So they didn't read the book, so they acted like the book said they would. Duh. And in the book, I say that this is what they already did to the Jost study. You know, where they had a two-day feeding frenzy, misunderstanding
it. Once it hit the headlines?
Right, 2003. Yeah. Misunderstanding it and just firing all their arrows at what they thought they saw across the range from them that wasn't there, and then forgetting about it and dropping it. And unfortunately, that seems to be the pattern of responding. So, you know, you could imagine a world in which everyone didn't act defensive for some reason, maybe because we had a different, if we had a different kind of politics and a different kind of discourse, I think you could imagine that world. And in that case, then you could imagine that we would say, okay, we have differences. You know, in some ways, we've always really known this, but now we really have to take it face on. And if we all accept this, then I think it leads to a place where we could get along better on this basis, because we would just be conscious of the fact that we have strengths, we have weaknesses, that's part of who we are, and so there could be a division of labor, there could be some kind of cooperation, there could be building in these assumptions of differences, and then we could actually do better that way, because you know, the research doesn't all make conservatives look bad. You know, it really shows a lot of liberal weak spots too, especially in terms of indecision. You know, it's bad for leadership to show weakness.
So some of the things, this is good, and I'm glad I meant to get here and I didn't. But some of the loyalty,
mm-hmm. That's obviously a weak spot.
A weak spot for liberals, a strong spot for conservatives,
right.
And a positive quality.
Patriotism, loyalty,
conviction,
all these things.
Commitment.
Yeah, sticking to the task and not diverting from it. Everything that I say makes them, you know, reality challenged also makes them have all these benefits. It's the same side of the coin. So you could imagine a world in which people, you know, put down their defensiveness and lay down their arms and had a productive discussion about this, right? Maybe America, a pre-culture war, maybe that could have happened. I mean, it was certainly a different America. But I see no reason to think that that will happen.
Right. So, Chris Mooney, if that's not going to happen, if we're not just going to say, oh, look, we've learned more about how we're different. We knew we were different. We've learned more about how we're different. Now how do we put that to play? Mm-hmm. But I think another question is, we've already said, that's unlikely to happen given, you know, that thinking that will happen depends on a bit of denial of what we've just been talking about.
Right.
But
when I see this on Fox News discussed in a serious way, then I'm going to change my mind.
Right.
Okay.
By the way, one thing I didn't get to was at one point you lay out three things that you say are crucial to why some of this stuff happens. And mm-hmm. just for people, could you lay that out, because I think it was helpful when I read it. And
I was just trying to explain in one of my spinoff articles why conservatives deny global warming, and I say you need a three-part explanation. You need to understand how they, you know, conservatism is defensive ideology, like we've talked about, and so it appeals to people that want certainty.
And defensive ideology just means
they want certainty.
Fend
yeah.
off
right, yeah.
information that doesn't agree with you.
Right, or just generally fend off change to the yeah. social structure, et cetera.
Yeah.
This is what conservatism has always been defined
right,
as.
Right.
But we're just finding the psychology and ultimately the biology of that. So, but then it, you know, it has a moral system, and so that means, you know, you defend your view of things. But then it has a moral system that leads to distrust of certain kinds of things, including climate science, because they view that as a threat to their view of how society should work, which is that it should be individualistic and everyone should get ahead, fall behind based on their merits, and the government shouldn't be picking winners. And so they're afraid that the government will interfere in the marketplace because of global warming. So that bothers them, and they don't believe global warming.
Right. In other words, am I correct in that one, that when you see such a big threat as global warming, it's probably going to take some unified action? It isn't the kind of thing we can individualistically
right, yeah. Cowboys can't fix global warming.
Right. right. So since you like cowboys, you deny
yeah,
global warming.
Basically, yeah. You know, survivalists can't stop global warming. So you got people who are threatened. You got people who have got this ideology, you know, that's characterized by defensiveness. And then you give them Fox News, which gives them the belief affirmation.
Now, when you say Fox News, are you linking Fox News to Rush Limbaugh? I mean,
To me, it's kind of the same thing.
That's what I figured. In other words, you call it that. That's shorthand for the right-wing echo chamber.
Right. But those are the two most prominent pieces
Absolutely.
Of it. And they make, in many issues like climate change, they make the same claims. In other words, they deny the science. Probably Limbaugh more vociferously than Fox, but Fox sows doubt. So then you have people who are defensive select into the information stream of Fox. They get the misinformation.
It reinforces.
Framed to support their values. Feedback, right? And so That's my account of how conservatives
yeah,
are so
I just
wrong.
Thought that was helpful to get
yeah.
that it's not one thing that does it. It's the psychology, it's the morality, and then it's the reinforcement.
Yeah.
And so on. So, Chris Mooney, finally, when I asked you how do we deal with this reality moving forward, you took it sort of, you stepped a step back and said, how do we integrate both? If I were going to make it more specific, which is how do people liberals, on the left, progressives, you name it. What can they take from this to communicate better, to strategize better, to actually try to use this information so that maybe we start dealing with global warming, for instance?
Mm-hmm. In the current configuration of politics, it sounds like conservatives aren't going to listen to this. So then, but it sounds like progressives are. I'm glad that they are. I appreciate that. And so what will they do? They are, by nature, more willing to change, so they're more open, so they're going to listen. So what are they going to do? Well, I think that the most important thing to learn is that, you know, your instincts are wrong. Your instincts are wrong because they're probably calibrated to only work for people like you. So if you set out to communicate in a fact-heavy way, if you, you know, include all this hedging language, you got to realize that there's a whole part of humanity that doesn't go down very well with them. They're looking for decisive. They're looking for leadership. So the style of communication can...
So you said two things there, by the way. One, you said sort of nuanced language is not going to be persuasive, but direct confrontation isn't going to work either with facts, right?
Yeah, but I think it's a little different. Hitting people head over the head with facts obviously doesn't work in any area where they have emotions. Also, liberal style of communication often doesn't work for people who aren't liberal. And then liberal moral assumptions don't work for people who aren't liberal. So all of those things – so in other words, those are three defaults that I think liberals tend to have that they just do without even thinking. And
one,
so,
the truth shall out.
Yeah.
Two, if I'm really –
Yeah, let's be careful. Let's state this cautiously.
Nuanced,
and,
blah,
you know,
blah. That,
let's be wonks.
And the third one?
And the third one, let's talk about fairness and equality
oh,
all the time.
Oh, right, right.
So, you know, all of those are assumptions and defaults that every day liberals are going around doing automatically. And what I'm saying is let's think about every one of those.
Right.
All right, and let's
They
break.
Will work if you're talking to a liberal.
Well, that's why they're defaults, right?
Exactly.
Because we have our own echo chambers,
right?
And we have our own emotions, and we have our own assumptions. Then we just naturally happens, right? And conservatives are doing the same thing. It feels natural to them, just like it feels natural to us. So I'm saying, let's think about every one of those steps, and let's just be conscious of them. I think another point that's implied in all this, and maybe it's yet another step, is about unity versus disunity. I think another instinct is, on the left is, first of all, if we disagree with someone liberal, then we go and make a stand, and criticize them, tear them down. And this is how we get, like, warring camps, like the atheist world is a bunch of different little atheist groups, and the environmental world is different little environmental groups. And, the Monty Python skit, it's actually The Life of Brian, they've got the People's Front of Judea versus the Judean People's Front. Do you know that? Right. So they this is liberals, right?
Right.
Everybody's a delicate flower, and, everybody's got to be different. And, of course, the conservatives, meanwhile, they're acting like a team.
That's right.
And they're going at it, and they're not giving up. And you wonder why they succeed. So that's another one of our instincts. It's hard to get past some of these instincts because there's a reason that we, mm-hmm. let all the thousand flowers bloom, and we hear all the voices, and we have three-hour meetings that, everybody gets to talk.
Yeah, the GA.
And nothing gets done.
The GA is the...
And nothing gets done. So there's much to learn about our own weaknesses, and I think that project will go forward more easily,
of course,
than the project of let's get conservatives to agree and let's make politics functional again. That seems to me a much more difficult challenge.
Okay, I think we got to leave it at that.
Okay.
Again, the book is The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. You can learn more at Science Progress Action, one word, scienceprogressaction.org/intersection, or RepublicanBrain.com, or you can just Google Chris Mooney. And he's not the singer, he's the journalist. Mm-hmm. Finally, thank you to Chris Mooney again. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.